So our last speaker today is Peter Goddard. Peter is a professor in this department and a close colleague, and he's also the master of St. John's College, which is the college in which Dirac spent many years. But Peter's intellectual connection with Dirac goes far beyond being the master of his college. He and I were both contemporary research students here in the late 1960s, and we both attended Dirac's final series of lectures. He used to lecture on quantum mechanics for a large number of years, and he gave his last lectures in 1969, I think. And of course, all of us were much influenced by these lectures, but I think probably Peter more than most. In fact, his influence can be seen both in the style and in the content of much of his subsequent research. He's very well known for making important contributions to string theory in its earliest days, in the early 1970s. And then, among many other achievements in theoretical physics, he's also well known for important work on magnetic monopoles, which was a subject that had been initiated by Paul Dirac in the 1930s. So Peter will now talk on beauty in the equations, aspects of Dirac's life and work.
Michael just carefully removed my notes as he left the stage. I had to pry them back from him. I'm a bit more technological than I normally am, so I hope absolutely nothing goes wrong with this. I chose the particular title, which won't surprise you after all else that's been said today, from writings of Dirac. A piece that, if you can read that, Dirac wrote, in which he said it's more important to have beauty in one's equations to have them fit experiment. It seems that if one is working from the point of view of getting beauty in one's equations, and here's the catch, and if one has a really sound insight, one is on a sure line of progress. And then he goes on and says, if there's not complete agreement between the results of one's work and experiment, one should not allow oneself to be too discouraged, because the discrepancy may be due to minor features that will get cleared up with further developments of the theory. And I don't know whether that's a suitable sort of apology for the end of a conference on string theory or not. You'd have to downplay the minor features aspect of it. Well, Dirac was writing about Schrödinger, but in the context of this centennial celebration of Dirac, this seems to me to, as often in the case when people write about other people, they reveal a lot about what they value and their own philosophy. I think that one should agree that it's Dirac's own work that demonstrates just how powerful this approach can be when it's adopted by somebody possessing the deepest insight and the highest aesthetic sense. It involves this idea of mathematical beauty. Dirac was once asked by a journalist when Victoria said he avoided them and the interactions were not always totally harmonious in the sense that there was a lack of meeting of minds. And the journalist asked Dirac to explain if he could explain what mathematical beauty was. And so Dirac said, well, do you understand mathematics? And the journalist said, no. He said, well, then I can't. That was described by Brian Appleyard as a monstrously arrogant statement, which I think completely misses the point. I think there's nothing arrogant about it at all. Now, being asked to say something about Paul Dirac's life and work at the end of this celebration is one of those flattering but almost unbearably onerous honours, but one that's very difficult to decline, however inadequately qualified one is. And I felt inadequately qualified before I came here, because I guess there will be a number of people in the audience who knew Dirac as a colleague, as a supervisor, and as a friend. And having arrived here, I can recognise vast numbers of them, so I feel even less qualified. In particular, in the audience, there's Dick Dalitz, who wrote the obituary of Dirac for the Royal Society, and I commend that in the biographical memoirs of the Royal Society if you want a not too long and very clear account of Dirac's life and work. As Michael has said, like many others here, I attended his lectures on quantum theory, which he gave over a period of about 40 years. And that was my interaction with him, apart from when I became a fellow of St. John's in 1975. I met him a number of times on his return visits back to college. Now, one of the features of Dirac is there are a lot of Dirac stories, and I won't be putting too many into this brief talk. And indeed, it did occur to me when I saw the audience that perhaps I should just scrap the talk and turn it into a sort of Quaker meeting in which people got up and told their own personal Dirac story. But that was actually unfortunately vetoed. The reaction to Dirac's lectures, I think, fell into two sorts of camps. Harris Chandra, who was a student as a theoretical physicist of Dirac, but later went on to become a distinguished professor of mathematics at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, attended Dirac's lectures when he first became Dirac's student in 1945. But as he puts it, he soon dropped out when I discovered that they were almost the same as his book. That is, of course, referring to the famous book, The Principles of Quantum Mechanics, first edition published in 1930, and which through its four editions has remained down this day, over 70 years, a textbook for students to profit from reading. On the other hand, I fell into the other camp. No Harris Chandra, I have to admit, to going to his lectures 2 years running in the 1960s. I was closer to the group represented by the physicist Paul Ehrenfest, who, experiencing some difficulties in following the arguments in one of Dirac's papers, wrote to him for an explanation, and he was delighted with Dirac's response when he first saw it, because he had a very long explanation which Dirac had written out in his characteristic handwriting, and then he sat down to read it and discovered, as he examined it carefully, that the text was almost exactly the same as the paper that he was trying to understand. But then he thought about it a bit more, and he said, and I think this is absolutely right, that it was true. The better one understands it, the better it is. That is, I certainly had this experience of reading Dirac's work and thinking it's so elegant and so succinct and so on, and then taking it away and thinking about it, and then thinking, but I've spotted the point he's overlooked, at least for a moment I thought that. And then you go back and look and you found you haven't quite remembered it. And he's that very carefully achieved the real height of pedagogy, which is to be intellectually accurate and honest, but not bother the student about the point the student shouldn't think about to begin with. So like many others, Dirac was and is my intellectual hero, but he more realised in actuality what one was worshipping than most heroes do. When I was a naive student in Trinity, I suppose, as a freshman, I couldn't quite understand why the greatest physicist in Cambridge was actually next door in St. John's and wasn't a Trinity man. It's only when I moved next door to St. John's I understood why that was. Now, I'm here for the parochial reason that I have the privilege of being the present head of the college that Dirac regarded as home. So I think I have to ask you to excuse me if this talk has a rather parochial bias, and I emphasise things particularly to do with Cambridge and those aspects of his life. Paul Maurice Adrian Dirac was born in Bristol on the 8th of August 1902, the second of the three children of Charles Dirac and Florence, whose maiden name was Holton. And Paul had an older brother and a younger sister. Dirac's father was Swiss by birth, and his family came from the Valais in Switzerland. But his father had run away to England after an unhappy childhood, and this has echoes in Dirac's life, marrying and settling in Bristol. And he eventually became head of modern languages at the Merchant Ventures School in Bristol, where Dirac received his secondary education from 1914 to 1918 in the Second World War. I was looking around for facts that I could put in this, because I knew there would be so many people in the audience who knew more about it than I did. And I came across one fact, which I suspect not many people know, which was before he went to Merchant Ventures School, he was at an elementary school, and one of his co-pupils was Cary Grant. Not many people know that. Well, Dirac was the young Dirac was always required to converse with his father in French at dinner times for the purpose of improving his proficiency in the language. This was the house rule, and that had to be done in complete and accurate sentences. For that reason, his mother and his brother and sister chose to eat in the kitchen, and leaving Paul alone with his father in the dining room. The effect of this was that he spoke through his life in carefully thought out sentences without too many words, and that thrift of words and taciturnity he was later famous for. Well, the curriculum at the Merchant Venturers School concentrated on the more sort of practical subjects: mathematics, physics, chemistry, modern languages. It didn't offer Latin, and for that reason not many of its pupils came to Oxford and Cambridge, which then required you to have Latin for admission. And most of Dirac's contemporaries going on to university went to university in their hometown, Bristol. And so Dirac followed his brother's steps, having been, as we've heard, having been rather unwilling because he wanted to do medicine rather than to do engineering. He followed his brother's footsteps when he was just 16. He gained entry to Bristol University at 15. He went to the university, which actually had premises in engineering in the same building as the secondary school. And his progress through the secondary school had been rapid because it had been facilitated in part by the gaps left in the higher classes by those who'd gone on to do war work in the First World War. In any case, through self-education, his knowledge of mathematics was in advance of the rest of his class. And he already was primarily motivated by a desire to understand the physical world. For example, he did not respond to the suggestion of one of his teachers that he would, given the way he seemed interested in mathematics, be interested in non-Euclidean geometry, because it seemed obvious to him that the real world was based on Euclidean geometry. Ironically, this was at the same time that he was beginning to try to understand the relationship of space and time and Einstein's special theory of relativity, which of course is expressed in those terms. Now, when he went to university and studied engineering, he concentrated on the theoretical aspects, and it is apparently the case that his experimental work was not as successful as his theoretical work. Indeed, he received a somewhat unfavourable report when he spent part of a long vacation of 1920 at the British Thompson Houston Works in Rugby to gain more practical experience. He graduated in 1921, almost 19, and at that point, although he'd graduated in electrical engineering with first class honours, the country was in economic depression and he couldn't easily have got a job. His father encouraged him to continue with his studies, and to this end he sat for an exhibition, a form of scholarship, at St John's College, Cambridge, in June 1921, the competition for the more valuable open scholarship had already taken place. And he won the maximum award he could on that rather restricted competition of £70 a year, but that wasn't enough to support him in Cambridge. And so instead of coming here in 1921, he remained in Bristol, where the university allowed him, without charging fees, to take the last 2 years of the mathematics course. So he qualified a second time for the BA degree. This is a portrait of Dirac, which is in the Royal Society. It painted in about 1939. As late as the summer of 1921, Dirac was still hoping to come to Cambridge, and this is a letter he wrote then to the tutor, Cunningham, asking him about various matters about coming there. And I put this up because I think it's interesting to compare it with this letter, which is written almost exactly 60 years later, which Dirac wrote to Abdus-Salam when he was unable to come to a conference on monopoles. And I think what's extremely interesting is that almost identical handwriting, unchanged from somebody of 19 to somebody 79. If you look at the signatures, for example, they're extraordinarily close. If you look at your own handwriting, somehow that seems to me a sort of outward symbol of Dirac's consistency of vision, and relates to the fact that you can still read this book written on quantum mechanics so soon after this greatest intellectual turmoil, arguably, of the 20th century, and get a clear exposition of the subject. Well, Dirac never regretted the time that he spent learning engineering. He believed it taught him to tolerate approximations, that all equations describing the actual world are only approximate. And even though the approximation gets better with successive theories, even the approximate equations can be beautiful. And it also helped him in more direct ways. For example, his dissatisfaction with the lack of a unified way in the engineering course of treating distributed continuous loads and point concentrated loads was one of the influences, he says, that led him to introduce his famous delta function some years later. In Bristol, mathematics, applied mathematics, was taught by Professor Henry Hasse, who'd been a fellow of St. John's College, and that was the particular thing which pointed him in this direction. And also by Peter Fraser, a gifted teacher who never published any of his own research, and who lectured on pure mathematics. And he had a profound influence on Dirac, particularly through his teaching of projective geometry. And it's such geometrical ideas that Dirac said underlay much of his research, even though he published the results in other terms. He said this many times. He said he published in other terms because projective geometry was not part of the normal educational language of theoretical physicists. It's interesting to reflect in relation to the way universities now are considered regulated position of Mr. Peter Fraser. There was one other student who was taking the honours course in mathematics when he spent those second 2 years, that second degree course at Bristol, and that was Beryl Dent, who later went on to do research still in Bristol on atomic physics. And when it came to specialising in the final year, Dirac, although interested in the physical world, was, I think, inclined to do algebra or geometry, whereas she was determined to do applied mathematics and theoretical physics. And as the department only had two students, it didn't seem reasonable to put on two courses. And for that reason, Dirac specialised in applied mathematics and theoretical physics in his last year and came directly under Hasse's influence. So he obtained first-class honours in mathematics, and with this second position now, he was able to supplement the exhibition he had, the £70 a year from St. John's College, by a grant from the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, which was the precursor of PPARC and the other research councils which were sponsoring this. And that was enough to enable him to do research. I think it approximated to £300 a year, quite a lot in those days. Now, when he came to up to St. John's in 1923, Dirac had hoped to do research in relativity under the supervision of Ebenezer Cunningham, to whom this letter had been written, and who'd examined him for his examination for the exhibition 2 years before. Hasse wrote to Cunningham about his protege. This is the letter, and I'm going to particularly concentrate on the last slide. There's a bit in which he describes Dirac. He said he's a bit uncouth and wants some sitting on hard, is rather recluse, plays no games, is very badly off financially, but has certainly got some very sound mathematical ideas and should be helped as much as possible. References in those days are more frank than they are nowadays. Well, Cunningham had pioneered the introduction of relativity into Britain, and Dirac was one of the people who did early work on conformal group and conformal invariance in physical theories. But he was actually in effect near the end of his research career, and the reason was that he'd had a hard time in the First World War. He was a conscientious objector, and for religious reasons. And after the First World War, he found it very difficult to be involved with the admission of students because the schools were biased against conscientious objectors and wouldn't send them candidates. And so he opted out of being a tutor and became steward of the college. And this is Cambridge route to disaster, of course. He became steward of the college and trying to battle with the cockroaches in the kitchens, which I won't comment on whether there are still cockroaches in John's kitchen. Was more than he could take, and so he felt unable to take on Dirac as a student. And this is a letter that he wrote back to Hasse about this. He said, "I should have been pleased to act as the supervisor of Dirac's work, but I anticipate a very busy year and do not want to take on anything at present. I think Fowler would make a very stimulating supervisor. He's, of course, on quantum theory and the structure of the atom." And then he says about Dirac, "If you think he's likely to be a real credit to the college, you might make an application for his admission." Well, yes, so that seemed to work out all right. So in fact, he came and was supervised by Fowler, who was a fellow at Trinity College and later Flamel Professor of Mathematical Physics. And so instead of beginning research on the geometrical aspects of relativity, Dirac was introduced by Fowler to atomic physics in the form that had been developed in the previous 20 years by Rutherford, Bohr, and others. And this was a real eye-opener for Dirac, because previously, from his previous understanding, he'd regarded atoms as rather hypothetical objects, and it came to him as a great surprise that, for example, the equations of classical electrodynamics, with which he was familiar, could be used to analyse the structure of the atom. And very quickly, then, he was plunged into the most profound problems of atomic physics, which was then in an incomplete and paradoxical state. This was 1923. Amongst the meetings that then took place, seminars and so on, to discuss current research in physics in Cambridge, were those of the Kapitsa Club, which had been founded in 1922 by Peter Kapitsa, a Russian who'd also trained as an electrical engineer, who'd come to the Cavendish Laboratory to work with Rutherford. It met after dinner, and this was an arrangement which Dirac found inconvenient, because by that time of the day, he was generally very sleepy. He believed his brain power to be at a maximum in the mornings, and that's when he did most of his work. The 4 hours a day we know that heard about. On the 28th of July 1925, the club was visited by Werner Heisenberg of Göttingen, who spoke on the subject term zoology and Zeeman botany, hardly immediately discernible as one of the great talks of all time. But towards the end of this talk, he described some new ideas of his, which later turned out to be the origins of his formulation of quantum mechanics. And by this stage, Dirac was too exhausted to take anything in. In fact, afterwards, he wasn't even clear whether he'd ever been at this meeting, but on balance, he thought he had. However, Fowler appreciated the importance of Dirac's remarks, and at the end of August, the end of the long vacation, Heisenberg sent the proofs of his first paper on quantum mechanics to Fowler. And this is the copy, and Fowler sent them on to Dirac, and who was then with his parents in Bristol, and he's written at the top, you can see, "What do you think of this? I shall be glad to hear." So Heisenberg's approach had been built up entirely in terms of observable quantities, and the observable quantities in atomic physics were mostly concerned with two states of an atom. This is a note that Dirac wrote, actually, probably in the 1960s, when his papers were first deposited in Churchill College's archives centre, but they're now in Tallahassee, on the significance of this of the document we just saw. So, with things associated with two states of an atom, Heisenberg was able to associate two-dimensional arrays and to develop the algebra of such arrays based on physical motivation. And he did this without realizing he was reinventing the algebra of matrices already known to pure mathematicians. Now, the most striking feature of this algebra, referred to slightly differently earlier, is that it's non-commutative. That is, that if you multiply things in one order, u times v, you don't get the same as if you multiply it in the other order, v times u. And this seemed very strange in a physical theory. It bothered Dirac, and he continued to think about it when he returned to Cambridge for the Michaelmas term in October. And he resumed his customary style of life, thinking intensely about such problems during the week, in the morning, and relaxing on Sunday by going for long walks in the country alone. And it was... This is Heisenberg and Dirac in Cambridge in the 1930s. On one of these Sunday walks in October 1925, in spite of trying to relax and get the things out of his head, he couldn't stop thinking about non-commutativity. And he suddenly realized this difference difference between multiplying one order and the other, UV minus VU, was like, had an analogy with a certain quantity in classical mechanics called the Poisson bracket. And he became very excited about this idea on his walk, but unable to decide whether there was anything in the idea because he couldn't see whether the details actually added up, checked out. So he hurried back to where he was living, and his notes and textbooks, which you can see, presumably now in Tallahassee, I looked at them when they were in Churchill, contain nothing on Poisson brackets. And being a Sunday, the libraries were shut. So he spent an anxious night, it didn't quite reveal whether it was all stayed up all night, but anyway, he spent an anxious night waiting, with his confidence gradually growing that he was onto something, until the libraries opened, and he was able to verify that this analogy was absolutely perfect. I mentioned now that the College Library at St John's College is open 24 hours a day, as is the Betty and Gordon Moore Library over here. This is this for current research students. The resulting paper, The Fundamental Equations of Quantum Mechanics, was received by the Proceedings of the Royal Society on the 7th of November. Although Dirac had been doing research now for just over 2 years, this was actually his 8th paper. Sometimes supposed that he didn't say very much, he didn't write very much. That was quite wrong. He wrote a lot of papers, well, not by the standards of certain sectors of theoretical physics today, but in the context. Now, in this, he solved the central problems of atomic theory, which have been baffling theoretical physicists for the previous decade. He established the basic equations of quantum theory and explained their relation to classical mechanics. In Göttingen, Born, Heisenberg and Jordan published two papers doing the former, but the elegant and profound relation with classical mechanics through Poisson brackets was Dirac's alone, at least published. I think Stater may also have had an idea in that direction. And it remains the basis for understanding the relationship between classical and quantum mechanics. Dirac regarded a lack of commutativity in the theory at first as a defect. Heisenberg regarded the lack of commutativity in the theory as a defect until he understood from Dirac's work that it's actually the central feature of quantum mechanics. Dirac has said in later years that nothing ever gave him as much satisfaction as this first major discovery. This is a bust of Dirac in the library of St John's College from the 1930s. Dirac developed his approach to quantum mechanics further, submitting papers in January and March and corresponding with Heisenberg about his progress. In the spring, he wrote his PhD thesis and obtained a degree in June, and he was now financed by a senior research studentship from the 1851 Exhibition Fund, which he was awarded in 1925. About this time, a paper appeared by Erwin Schrödinger, giving an apparently completely different version of quantum mechanics, that based on the wave function, wave mechanics. And it was couched in terms, used because it used differential equations, more familiar to many physicists. At first, Dirac's reaction to this was hostile, but by August, he mastered Schrödinger's formalism, by studying its consequences for indistinguishable electrons, he gave a derivation of Pauli's exclusion principle and the consequent Fermi-Dirac statistics, which have been referred to earlier. In his next paper in December 1926, and arguably his greatest, he published the general mathematical framework for quantum mechanics, which is basically that still used. And within this framework, the distinction between Heisenberg's and Schrödinger's approaches disappear. They're different systems of coordinates, if you like. Having obtained his doctorate, Dirac was free to travel, go to conferences and the like, and was already, of course, now a major international figure. In 1926, he went to Copenhagen to visit Niels Bohr's institute, moving on in February to spend several months in Göttingen. He continued his habit of working hard through the week and going for long country walks on Sundays in order to relax. But these walks were no longer usually solitary. In Copenhagen, he was often accompanied by Bohr, and in Göttingen by Robert Oppenheimer, who lived in the same lodgings as Dirac and with whom he became close friends. They were extraordinarily different people. Dirac found the polymath Catholic interests of Oppenheimer very difficult to understand. Oppenheimer spent much time reading Dante in the original Italian at that time. And it said that Dirac once said to Oppenheimer, how can you do both physics and poetry? In physics we try to explain in simple terms something that nobody ever knew before, and in poetry exactly the opposite. Now whilst in Copenhagen, this is distracting with Oppenheimer. Whilst in Copenhagen, Dirac applied his general formalism to the electromagnetic field, showing it to be described in quantum mechanical terms as an assembly of particles, photons, just as really have been conjectured, if you like, by Planck and Einstein in their work, which had motivated much of the original development of quantum mechanics. So in doing so, he really brought together the various strands of the development of the subject into a coherent whole, removing once and for all, one says, the dichotomy between waves and particles, and simultaneously he created the subject of quantum electrodynamics. Having returned to Cambridge, Dirac was elected to a research fellowship of his college in 1927, and he remained a fellow of the college until he died. Now in 1927, the end of 1927, the major outstanding problem in theoretical physics, arguably, was to reconcile quantum mechanics with the other revolution in physics that had been made at the beginning of the 20th century, that is, the theory of relativity. And many thought that this problem had in some sense already been solved, but Dirac saw clearly that the supposed solution was unsatisfactory. And in 1928, in two papers that are perhaps his most famous, he produced his relativistic wave equation, the relativistic quantum theory of the electron, and that wave equation became known as the Dirac equation, except in Dirac's lectures. You could go to Dirac's lectures and come out of them after the course and not know what the Dirac equation was, because you thought it was the thing was called the relativistic wave equation the whole way through. And so, unless you tied it in with other pieces of information, that piece of modesty was slightly in the way. So, our one equation for the lecture. Of course, for those of you who are not theoretical physicists and mathematicians, the excitement, the beauty and so on of that equation is not evident. I don't know if it's made more evident by this thing from the Institute of Physics. Whether that helps you or not, I'm not sure. In fact, I think I'll go back to... Well, Dirac's theory made the previous candidate's theory look thoroughly anemic, and it had devastating consequences. It required the electron to have very definite properties, spin and magnetic moment, which agreed with experiment. And from the outset, Dirac noticed that there were negative energy solutions to the equation, and he assumed from the outset too, he proposed from the outset that they should be associated with some other particle with opposite charge to that of the electron. Initially, although it had a very different mass, getting on for 2,000 times the size, it was thought this must be the proton, because the only particles around really at the time were the proton, the electron, and via the electromagnetic field, the photon. And there they were all together in one equation. So almost particle physics was over before it had really begun. However, of course, the identification with the proton wasn't correct, and it was understood more clearly that it had to have the same mass, the positive charged particle, which was predicted by the equation, and in this way, the existence of the positron, the anti-electron, this is one of Dirac's talks on the subject, was predicted clearly by Dirac, and it was confirmed by experiment in 1932. Dirac's prediction of antimatter, well, this is the Institute of Physics again, was described by Heisenberg, this is them together much later in life, I think in the 1960s, was described by Heisenberg as the most decisive discovery in connection with the properties or nature of elementary particles. It completely changed our whole outlook on atomic physics. So with these developments, quantum mechanics was in essentially complete form, from a certain point of view. And Dirac, by this time, in 1931, 8 years after beginning as a research student, had already published 35 papers, many of them, but not all, colossal contributions to the development of theoretical physics. What I've been able to do here is only to mention the very greatest highlights, obviously, and I can't had no time to review the rest of his work. In 1931, for example, in that same year, he wrote the first of his famous papers on the singularities in the electromagnetic field, which led him inexorably, by his characteristic logical reasoning, to predict the existence of magnetic monopoles. And this paper contains this particular beginning, rather reminiscent of the lecture you've had distributed, in which Dirac argues that it will be necessary to develop very powerful mathematical tools in order to be able to develop the right sort of indirect intuition to build physical theories. Well, although this paper led to the idea that there must exist magnetic monopoles, indeed modern physical theories, unified field theories, continue that line of argument and that conviction, Dirac in his later years, in the thing I showed you earlier, when invited to a conference in 1981 on monopoles, unable to come, said he didn't believe. He had begun to take notice of experiments at this point, at least over the years. Well, Dirac's enormous achievements were recognised by his election to the Royal Society in 1930 at the age of 27 or 28, and his election as Lucasian professor in 1932, when he was still only 29. In 1933, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics. This is the photograph of Dirac's Nobel Prize medal, which is in St. John's College Library, I hope still. when Dirac went to Stockholm to collect this, it was with Schrödinger, with whom he shared the prize, and also with Heisenberg, who was awarded that year the prize for the previous year. It was awarded late. And Schrödinger was with his wife, and Dirac and Heisenberg with their mothers. Dirac didn't take his father, and that was been taken as a sign of the strained relations which existed between him and his father in later years. Well, Dirac had been lecturing on quantum mechanics since 1927. He was a university lecturer in mathematics for the 3 years before he was made professor. And out of these lectures grew his famous book, The Principles of Quantum Mechanics, which for over 50 years has remained a standard text to be recommended to those learning the subject. It's a testimony to the clarity of his vision and the depth of his perception that he was able to write this definitive text so soon after this great conceptual revolution. J.G. Crowther, representing OUP, visited Dirac in St. John's College and found him sitting at a folding wooden desk just writing the book straight out. And the manuscript, largely free from corrections, now in the library in Tallahassee, along with many of Dirac's other manuscripts and personal papers, confirms that picture. Eventually, the approach that was in Dirac's book became the standard language of quantum theory. This is a portrait of Dirac painted just after the Second World War by a student, and it was in Dirac's possession until he left Cambridge. Dirac continued to lecture in Cambridge until his retirement from the Lucasian chair in 1969. He supervised comparatively few research students. He took the view that the problems on which he was working were not suited for most students, being a sort of indefinite outcome. And for many years, his was the first course in quantum theory that a Cambridge student would take. The brevity and precision of many of his comments were legendary, and the fact that he wouldn't answer things at length, and many of those are the heart of Dirac's stories, though some of the stories are rather simplistically interpreted, or very simplistically interpreted, as implying that Dirac was being simple or simplistic, but that is not quite, that's not the point of the stories if you think about them. One famous story recounts how, after Dirac had given a lecture, a member of the audience stood up and said he couldn't understand a particular equation. There was a long silence, and the chairman then asked Dirac whether he was going to answer the question, and Dirac replied he thought it had been a statement. Well, if Dirac had done nothing after the early 1930s, he'd still be ranked amongst the greatest names in the whole history of physics. But his work did continue unabated in later years, and there are many ideas, though out of tune with the physics at the time, which have come down and influenced us greatly in the years in which I've been involved in research, and I'm sure will continue in many years to come. He didn't move with the herd in those later years, but did things of great prescience and long-term influence. He continued to go around the world visiting physicists elsewhere. This is Dirac at in the late 1940s at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, where he used to like to go, particularly, of course, under Oppenheimer's, when Oppenheimer was director there, remained friends with Oppenheimer. In the 1950s, he planned a visit in 54, 55, at the time of when Oppenheimer was in great difficulty because of the McCarthy atmosphere, and Dirac was actually not allowed to enter the States at that time. He was denied a visa, possibly because of his connections with Tam as well, the Russian physicist, as well as Oppenheimer. This picture of Dirac talking to Feynman, sorry, Feynman talking to Dirac, is one which is a particular favourite of mine. Well, when Dirac retired from the Lucasian chair, he moved to first to Miami and then to Tallahassee. But he would come back to college from time to time, particularly in the summers. I mean, there is a story told that when he was here, he wouldn't work in the department very much. He worked very much at home. In fact, I remember one occasion when I was a student talking to my supervisor, John Polkinghorne, and there was a knock on the door. This was just after we'd moved into the buildings, temporary buildings we were in Silver Street for 35 years. And there was a knock on the door, and there was Dirac bringing around a pile of preprints, which he'd received over the preceding few months. And he said, "You seem to have forgotten to tell me you moved." So he didn't come into the department very much. So I remember in his last year he came in and joined us at coffee on a few occasions. And the first time he came, he was given some coffee. And then he said, "How much are the biscuits?" And so somebody said, "Well, for you, they're free." He said, "But I might want to come again." Which he did. But in Florida, in Tallahassee, he worked much more in the department. And when he was asked why that was, what the particular quality of the department, he said the air conditioning doesn't work very well at home. Well, he would come back to college in the 1970s, he was back one year I think it was 1981, and sitting next to my predecessor at one as head of the college at dinner, he was asked by my predecessor, who was a historian, and didn't find it that easy to make conversation with Paul Dirac, what on earth he did with his gown when he went back, because one wears gowns at dinner here, but he assumed one didn't wear gowns in general in Florida. Dirac said, well, he took it back with him because he had nowhere to leave it here now. He didn't have a room in Cambridge, he didn't have a house. And so the master, Harry Hinsley, said, "Well, you shouldn't, you know, don't do that. Give it to the porters and tell them to bring it to me, and I will keep it for you." And here it is. It's hanging in the cloakroom of the lodge, the master's lodge in St. John's College, where I live. And on it is a label, now carefully protected, which says, "Professor Dirac's gown. Please keep it. Please take it to the master and ask him to keep it until the next time I come to Cambridge." Well, sadly, he never came again, and Dirac was... There are two things about this. Dirac was precise and literal, and so we've respected the request. It's there. And I regard it sort of a bit like Excalibur, that when we need him, he will come. And so the gown waits there for that to happen. His portrait hangs in the hall. This is a portrait by Michael Notes from 1978. As I said, he didn't come back again, so he didn't come in particular for his 80th birthday. Or the custom in St. John's is, and I'm sorry you can't read this very well, but the the custom in St. John's is on the 27th December, the feast of St. John, to celebrate the 80th birthday of any fellow who's attained that in the last year. And he couldn't come, and he said, sent a message here saying, "I'm sorry I cannot be present. When the fellows drink my health, please give them my regrets that I'm not with them and my thanks for their good wishes, and tell them that for 59 years the college has been the central point of my life and a home to me." Very touching message. Dirac was commemorated in Westminster Abbey due to the leadership and efforts of Dick Dalletz, and those of us who played a minor role in that were all agreed that the equation should appear on the stone. It's the only equation in the Abbey, and we did manage to convince them it had no sinister significance. Dirac's unique intellect was evident in everything that he wrote. Rudolf Pyle suggested it was Dirac's absolutely straight thinking in unexpected ways that made his work so characteristic. He didn't follow conventions, but rather thought everything out from first principles. And Bohr said that Dirac had the purest soul and the most remarkable scientific mind since Newton. It's difficult to convey that, but there's a couple of stories which I thought did that. I'll just end more or less end with those. One is to try to convey to those of you who don't have mathematics the nature of this unexpected thinking. It's a story of Casimir's. Casimir was visiting Göttingen in 1929, and for relaxation at coffee time, the physicists were playing the game of four twos, and the idea of this game is to try to express these natural numbers using four twos, using a set of arithmetical operations. You can use as many arithmetical operations as you like, but you've got to use four twos. So you go on like this, and so on. And you see how high you can get. It's a mindless game, really. But they were sitting around doing this, and there were arguments because in some countries you have different notations. Could you use double factorial? Was that an allowed notation? And so on. And people worked hard and displaced themselves from the really hard stuff of doing theoretical physics, of course, and displayed considerable ingenuity at sort of beating hypothetical records. And Dirac didn't get involved in that. He was sort of sitting around the edge and didn't seem to want to get involved in this triviality. And so they turned to Dirac and said, "What can you do? Can you do this?" He said, "Well, I did think about it, and I can express the natural number n using three twos." This, of course, completely killed the game. But and what he did, and again, it's a slight cheat, you see. This is it. You take 2, and you take its square root n times, and then you take log to the base 2 twice, and then you negate it. I have tried this before offering a bottle of champagne, but I didn't have time this time, unfortunately, and you wouldn't have got it unless you'd seen it before. And the other story, which is, I said that what people say about themselves, the stories they tell often say more about them, and it's a story that Dirac apparently liked to tell, and it's this. It's a story, a little joke, if you like. In a small village, a newly appointed priest went to call on his parishioners. And on a visit to a quite modest home, he was received by the woman of the house. And he couldn't but fail to notice that the house, the complete house, was teeming with children. And he asked her how many children she and her husband had. And she replied, 10, 5 pairs of twins. And the priest, astonished, says, "You mean you had twins every time?" And to which the woman replied, "No, Father, sometimes we had nothing." I thought that I should actually end this just by letting Dirac have the last word in the message, which is maybe slightly, is views he often expressed and might be touch pessimistic, but there you are.
The problems are more difficult, and there's not the same hope of making rapid progress which there was in those days. Excitement is usually combined with a hope of making rapid progress when any second-rate student can do really first-rate work. But the easier problems have now all been worked out. Those that are left are very difficult to work on, and one doesn't seem able to get the right basic ideas. It's quite possible that they will require wholly new ideas. In fact, it's pretty certain they will, otherwise they would have been thought of.
Well, that seems to me to be an appropriate way to end this talk and also perhaps a conference on string theory.
Thank you all for coming. That concludes the meeting.